And after 48 years, I love
Hang on
it.
One second, Walt. I don't know what's going on with this mic.
Oh, well, honey, I don't know either.
Okay, try that now.
Welcome. No, why don't we hit Nikki Giovanni then?
All right.
This is not a poem. This is hot chocolate at the beginning of spring, topped with hand-whipped double cream. A splash of brandy to give it sass and just a little cinnamon to give it class. This is not a poem. This is a summer quilt, log cabin pattern. See that corner piece? That was grandmother's wedding dress. That was grandpapa's favorite Sunday tie. That white strip there is the baby who died. Mama had pneumonia, so the red flannel shows the healing. This does not hang from museum walls, nor will it sell for thousands. This is here to keep me warm. This is not a sonnet, though it will sing. Precious Lord, take my hand. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Go down, Moses, way down to the past, way up to the future. It will swell with the voice of Marian Anderson, lilt on the arias of Leontine, dance on the trilling of battle, do the dirty, dirty with Bessie, moan with Dinah Washington, rock and roll through the 60s, rap its way into the 90s, and go on into space with Etta James saying, at last, no. This is not a sonnet, but the truth of the beauty that the only authentic voice of planet Earth comes from the black soil, tilled in mind by the daughters of the diaspora. This is a rocking chair, rock me gently in the bosom of Abraham. This is a bus seat, no, I'm not going to move today. This is a porch where they sat spitting at fireflies, telling young Alex the story of the African. This is a hook rug to cover a dirt floor. This is an iron pot with leftover vegetables making a slow cooking soup. This is pork simmering chitlins, surprising everybody with our ability to make a way out of no way. This is not rest when we are weary, nor comfort when we are sad. It is laughter when we are in pain. It is never mind when we are confused. It is keep climbing, child, when the road takes the unfair turn. It is don't let nobody turn you around when our way is dark. It is the faith of our mothers who plaited our hair, put Vaseline on our faces, polished our rundown shoes, patched our dresses, wore sweaters so that we could wear coats, who welcomed us and our children when we were left alone to rear them, who said, get your education and nobody can put you back. This is not a poem, no. It is a celebration of the road we have traveled. It is a prayer for the roads yet to come. This is an explosion, the original Big Bang that makes the world a hopeful, loving place. This is the black woman. In all our trouble and glory, in all our past history and future forbearance, in all that ever made love a possibility, this is about us. Bleached and natural, braided and straightened hair, made up or beaten up faces, tall, short, stately bent, CC riders, junkies, whores, wives, mothers, grandmothers, aunts, working in the home or outside, working in the system or outside, working, praying, working to survive, giving pride, giving succor, giving voice, giving encouragement, giving whatever we can give. This is a flag that we placed over Peter Salem and Peter Poor, the 54th Regiment from Massachusetts, all the men and women lynched in the name of rape, Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. This is a banner we fly for respect, dignity, the assumption of integrity, for a future generation to rally around. This is about us, celebrating ourselves. And a well-deserved honor it is. Light the candles. This is a rocket. Let's ride.
It's a rocket. That's Nikki Giovanni, and I want to do a white privilege supremacy. I'm glad Jeff Epstein is dead, but are we here?
Yes. I was going to say, but we're not. We're criticizing white supremacy, correct?
Excuse me. I'm endorsing. I just played Nikki Giovanni. This is the Talking Earth. I'm Walt Curtis, and I want Patrick to chime in. What I would say, we have a little time here. I want to play some Langston Hughes, and then my friend Ray Burley will call in. He has a new book of poetry, and he's going to call in from Depot Bay. And then not yet, Ray, do not call yet, about 10:15 or, but really, I think we should continue with the black women deal here, and we'll pick up Langston if we want. Now, you have to know this, Patrick, I'm going to kick this in here. Democracy Now, Toni Morrison died, who wrote Beloved and Only Blue Eyes, and Angela Davis, and Angela Davis and Sonia Sanchez and Nikki were on Democracy Now on Friday. You can do it on cable. You can go to Democracy Now. So I'm just the sound. I'm going to put it down like I do here, and we're going to see what happens with this. You can adjust the sound, Patrick.
All right,
Bucard. So let's.
Toni Morrison for the first time.
This is Angela Davis
after
talking.
The conclusion of my trial. She was an editor at Random House Publishing Company, and she approached me with the idea of my writing an autobiography. And of course, at that particular moment, I wasn't interested in writing an autobiography. Besides, I was 28 years old, and I thought, who writes an autobiography in their 20s? This is a project that should wait several decades. And I also imagined the autobiography as genre as something that was produced by people who had standing in the world, who felt that they had lived their lives in a way that would provide model for people in the world. And I told her this, but she was very insistent. And when I explained what kind of work I might produce that might not fit into the genre of a what I thought would be an individualistic autobiography, she persuaded me that I could write a political autobiography. Toni, of course, had a way of creating the arguments that could persuade you to do anything. So eventually, I agreed, and that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship. I'm so happy that I wrote an autobiography, if only for the reason that it introduced me to Toni Morrison.
I want to go, Angela, to a clip from a 2010 conversation between Toni Morrison and you, Angela Davis, at the New York Public Library. She sort of laboriously came up onto the stage and immediately joked about how she had just had hip replacement. The rest of her body had to catch up with her magic hip. But you were both speaking at the event called Frederick Douglass, Literacy, Libraries, and Liberation. Here, Toni Morrison talks about the legal creation of whiteness.
The interesting thing is that they established these laws, and the laws were very, very interesting. They said things like, no black shall be allowed to carry a weapon ever for any circumstance. Second, any white can maim or kill any black for any reason without being charged. Now, you see what that did to the indentured servants who were white? Now they're better, freer, more powerful. They're in the same situation. They're still enslaved, but they're not, but they can carry weapons and they can beat up black slaves without punishment. Mm-hmm. So they have this little margin of status, nothing else, but that little margin. And that little margin has worked its way through this country since then. That was in the 17th century. And, you know, the Southern strategy, you know, all these things in which you flag race and racism as a cause or even a goal. You know, racism is not a goal. It's a path. It's just a route to power and money. That's what it is. That's what it's for, whether it's via war or segregation or what have you. The thing itself is just a manipulation and a tool. And its purpose is what I just described that went on after the Bacon Rebellion.
I wanted to turn to Nikki Giovanni right now, poet, activist, professor, currently the University Distinguished Professor at Virginia Tech. Professor Giovanni is the author of over 24 books, her latest, Good Cry, What We Learned from Tears and Laughter. Professor Giovanni, I went to see you at Virginia Tech years ago. It was after the Virginia Tech massacre. We sat in your office, and you kept getting interrupted by phone calls because you were extremely excited about preparing this event at Virginia Tech, where you and Maya Angelou would be celebrating the life of Toni Morrison as she was coming. It was after the death of her son, and you just wanted to cheer her up and share her magnificence with the world. Can you talk about how you first met Toni Morrison and what she has meant for you?
Well, I first met Toni because I stalked her. I read The Bluest Eye, and I was living in New York, and simply walked. I lived on 92nd in Central Park West, and I walked down to Random House because I never did understand how to take a subway. And I walked down to Random House and said, you know, I'd like to see Toni Morrison. And the security guard said, you know, is she expecting you? And I said, well, no. And he said, who are you? And I wrote my name and sent it up, and she sent the message back, asked her to wait. And she came back down after a few, I guess she cleaned her desk or whatever. And we went across the street and had a cup of coffee. And it was just, you know, when you're talking to any genius, you're shy. I don't know if I'm shy, but certainly trying to find the right words. But we had a cup of coffee, and a relationship grew out of that. When Slade died, I went down to see Maya, and I said down because Maya was at Wake Forest, and I said, you know, what should we do? And it wasn't cheer her up, because you lose a child, you can't be cheered up, but it was to comfort. And the sisterhood had to come in, and good morning, Angela, and good morning, Sonia, because both of them, we called Angela right away because I knew that they were close, and of course Sonia came. We had a sheer good fortune because Toni had said it's sheer good fortune to miss someone before they're gone. And I'd just like to say, you know, we're talking about it today that we've lost Toni. But Toni Morrison is Shakespeare. Toni Morrison is a storyteller like Jesus. We will never lose Toni Morrison. She will always be here. And she'll be here in somebody else's mind, and she'll look like something. You know, we'll look like we're fighting about how does Shakespeare look or something. But Toni Morrison will always be with us because she has created a body of work of genius, and it'll always be there. It 200 years from now, we'll be reading Toni.
Professor Giovanni, you mentioned The Bluest Eye. I want to go to another clip of that 2010 conversation between Toni and Angela Davis at the New York Public Library.
When I wrote the first book I wrote, The Bluest Eye, I really wanted to know why that girl felt so bad. The one who, a real life girl, who said she wanted blue eyes. We were talking about whether God existed. I, of course, was persuaded that he did. And she was persuaded that he did not. And her proof was that she had prayed for blue eyes for 2 years. 2 years? And she didn't get them. So, obviously, he wasn't up there. But when I looked at her and thought about how awful she would look. If she got them. And then I thought, the second thing was, how beautiful she was at that moment, you know. She was just incredible, but I didn't even know whether she was beautiful or not until I thought about what she might think. Then the third thing, of course, is why does she want that? You know, what makes her think that's an improvement? And that kind of self-loathing, which is real, you know, in, when you don't have any support, made me, you know, think of that as a real subject for a book. Not some old victim, but really how it works.
Nikki Giovanni, as Toni Morrison talks about writing The Bluest Eye, about a young black girl in rural Ohio in the 1940s, who was raped by a father driven to madness. If you can talk about the significance of this book and why you walk to meet her. It was a 2000 pick for the Oprah Winfrey's book club, and people might say, oh, why are you raising that now? Well, actually, Oprah Winfrey said she wouldn't have even have made a book club if it weren't for Toni Morrison. Nikki Giovanni.
And I think she's right. You know, Pecola didn't like herself, and I think that's what Toni was dealing with, that Pecola, the bluest eye was just a metaphor. Pecola wanted to be something that somebody could be seen, that she could look at herself. And I tell you, the kid that I like so much right now is Renee Watson, who is a big woman. And she's begun writing about what it is to be a big woman, that she can look at herself. Because you look at yourself and you say, oh, I'm too fat. I'm somebody who always needs to gain weight because I've had a situation with cancer. I'm not fighting cancer. I'm trying to live with it. But I need to gain weight. I need to make sure that my weight doesn't, I don't want to lose weight. And we live in a world that I turn on my television, and it's like, wow, you can lose weight. I don't want to lose weight. I want to gain weight. But there are people who are waiting, who are big, and nobody's writing about them except Renee is writing about them. I think she's a brilliant young woman. I think the next novelist should be Edwidge Dadaka, who is just an incredibly wonderful, wonderful writer. So when we start to look at what made Pecola, if Pecola had been able to read Renee or had been able to read Edwidge, or had been able, for that matter, to read, and I love him so much, Kwame Alexander. If she had been able to find somebody that said, but you are a pretty girl. It's all right. And you say, well, rape is a horrible thing. I think rape is pretty bad. I've never been raped, so I'm happy about that. But I think that it's not something that the person who was raped did. It's something that was done to you. And so things that are done to you, you have to find a way to push that. You have to find a way to push that back. It's not your fault. And I think that Toni was taking the steps to say, it's not your fault. I mean, Ohio, look at Ohio right now, and that'd be a whole discussion that we're not going to have. But look at Dayton. And look at what's happening in, look at what happened in America. And so we got to do better, so we need a little more. We need a little more Toni Morrisons.
And I do actually want to talk about that with you before the end of the show, because here you are at Virginia Tech, 32 people killed in the massacre there. You taught the actual shooter, and that's another discussion, but I do want to get back to it. However, I want to go to Sonia Sanchez right now, the award-winning poet, one of the foremost leaders of the Black Studies and Black Arts Movement, author of 20 books, including Morning Haiku and Shake Loose My Skin. Sonia, you've said what Toni has done with her literature is that she's made us look up and see ourselves. Explain when you first discovered her, how you teach her to your students, what she has meant in your own writing.
Good morning, Sister Angela and Sister Nikki and Sister Amy. It is good being on this program. I just had surgery on my mouth yesterday, so I'm hoping that you can understand what I'm saying. My dear sister, we were at the beginning of the Black Studies movement here in America, and I was blessed to initiate the first course on the Black woman in America. And that was at the University of Pitt in 1969. And of course, when I moved back to the East and came back home, I then had to begin to look for books and other books that I had to include in that discussion of Black women. And I, of course, read The Bluest Eye. Let me tell you, my dear sister, when I read The Bluest Eye, I sat down on the floor. You know, I read in all kinds of positions, sometimes in bed, stretched out, sometimes on the couch, you know, sitting rigid, sometimes walking back and forth as I read. I did not put that book down. I literally started it from the beginning, and later on that night up in my study where I had ended with a cup of hot tea, that I began to finish that book. And, you know, and what I knew that this woman, this Sister Toni Morrison, did something with language, with words, how she, in a sense, in that book and all the other books, untangled this language that had captured us in this place called America, how she began to stand those words up, and how she let those words minuet our blood, you know. And so she opened up this thing called sorcery, the sorcery of our language. And she was spitting teeth on our words, but she was recapturing our most sacred vows, those vows in our language, in a place called America. And you know, I taught that that book. That was one of the books that I constantly taught, that I always said to Sister Toni, when people began to talk about her greatest book, you know, I said, well, you know, I always gravitate back towards The Bluest Eye, because of what it says and what it does for us as black women. I, at some point, began to look and understand that, you know, in many African cultures, when you have twins, it is said that the first twin that comes out, you know, to search and make sure it's okay for the second twin. So you come out and you look around. I maintain when I teach that the Bluest Eye was that first twin coming out, looking around, searching, say, is it okay to say this? Is it okay what I'm going to say? Is there fertile land for this? Are there fertile eyes for this? Is there fertile memories of what I'm going to say? You know, and then all the other children came out from Sulu on down, you know, to Beloved. But that first one, the Bluest Eye, was the one that came out to say, hey, is it safe to do this? Let me tell you what's happening out here as you prepare to bring us these other books, right? So one of the things, every time I read her, I would always put on my eyes. You know, I used to tell her this, because I was always in the eyelash of her memory, where there was always a miracle called Sister Toni Morrison.
Yeah. We're going to break, and we're going to come back to this discussion. We're talking to Sonia Sanchez. We're talking to Nikki Giovanni, and we're talking to Angela Davis about the late, great Toni Morrison. She died at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx with complications
Morrison,
of pneumonia
wrote Beloved,
Monday night. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Why don't we stop that? And so that was on Democracy Now! If you want to hear the whole program, it was a wonderful tribute, I believe, for Toni Morrison with, Angela Davis, Nikki Giovanni, and that's why I did that, and Sonia Sanchez. And you know, KBOO archives this stuff. We have this. That was on Democracy Now!, I believe, on my brain is trying to work, on Friday or Thursday. Ray Burley should be calling in. If he's not going to, I'll call him on the phone on the side here. But you know, KBOO is the greatest community radio station in the United States of America, and possibly in the world. And Patrick, I saw you, Patrick, listening to that stuff, and I didn't like the lower level sound. It was just, okay. So what do you think? About white privilege, white supremacy.
I was going to talk about Toni Morrison, if that's all right.
Well, no, talk about Toni Morrison. Talk about her, please.
You know,
did she impress you?
I mean, I really like Beloved. Actually, I hate to say it, it's like, I don't know if I have every book of hers. I think I have The Bluest Eye and I haven't read it, and I need to go back and read it. After reading that description, I really want to read it.
Tell me about The Beloved. She actually is a black woman who got the Nobel Prize.
She won the Nobel Prize, yes.
And not only that, she won the Pulitzer. Go ahead. You talk about Toni Morrison.
Can't remember if she won the National Book Award for Beloved or the Pulitzer, one or the other.
Yeah, I know.
But Beloved's a great book. It's actually up my alley because it's a ghost story.
Why do you like it? It's a ghost story?
It is a ghost story.
Well, talk about it, please.
It's, I don't want to spoil anything.
No, spoil it.
No. I want people to read that great book.
Go ahead.
One of the things I like about it, she uses stream of consciousness in it. There's a really weird passage that I have a really hard time understanding. I had a really hard time understanding, and I might even have to reread it again to completely get it. But where I think it's a stream of consciousness from the point of view of the ghost.
Well, you're into science.
But basically, yeah. And I won't tell the whole story, but this freed African-American woman who this is a couple years, like 5 years after the Civil War. I can't remember if she's still in the South or the North. I mean, it's been a long time since I read it, but her daughter who is dead comes back, and her daughter wasn't named. So her daughter took the name that was on the gravestone, Beloved.
Oh, is that?
And that's
where
the
title
comes
from
that. And it is a really, it's a great novel. I started reading Song of Solomon.
Well, you're white, aren't you? You're white.
Yeah, I'm Irish American, yes. I still feel it's a great novel. I started reading Song of Solomon, and I couldn't really get going on it, and my dad scolded me because he loves Song of Solomon.
Your dad? What does your dad do? Come on.
My dad was an English teacher in high school.
Well, let's be personal here. Come on.
He was an English teacher in high school. He loves James Joyce. And to be honest, Toni Morrison has definitely read James Joyce because she uses some of the same techniques. And my dad really likes Song of Solomon over Beloved. But hearing that description of The Bluest Eye, I really need to read that.
I think we all need to read that. because I
do have to say, I went to Powell's and I tried finding a couple of her books. And, of course, they were sold out. Because that's what happens. And so I bought a book by Colson. I'm going to...
Oh, no, don't worry. Just
it's
keep
the
talking.
Underground Railroad.
We're at 10:30. Are you out there, Burley?
I just started reading it by Colson Whitehead, and it's really good. And it's not necessarily the same style as Toni Morrison, or Alice Walker, for that matter, too.
No, I love Alice Walker, a movie you could name. But, you know, really, I'm impressed that you, as an Irish white person about, let's say, 40. I don't know. I'm not going to go there.
All right.
I really think that I really think that anyone who is white or black should listen to the Talking Earth and this community radio station, because we've dealt with these issues. I'm not saying I've done it right or you've done it right. I'm just saying we've dealt with these issues. And what I want to say is I was going to turn something. I actually want to turn Ray Charles on. But what have we got over there? Just hit one of those and see what we got. Just a little bit. Billie Holiday.
We're going to stick with the African-American woman for now.
Sure we are. That's why I do this program.
I think so.
We'll see what we got there. But, you know. Yeah, we'll just do a song. Yeah. Keep me alive.
Do nothing till you hear from me.
Oh, my God.
Pay no attention to but sad. Why people tear the seams of anyone's dream. Here's over my head. Do nothing till you hear from me. At least consider our romance. If you should take the word of others you've heard, I haven't a chance. True, I've been seen with someone new. But does that mean that I'm untrue when we're apart? The words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memory. And the may hold a thrill, but please do nothing till you hear it from me, and you never will. True, I've been seen with someone new. But does that mean that I'm untrue when we're apart? The words in my heart reveal what I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memory. And the arms may hold a thrill, but don't do nothing till you hear it from me, and you never will. Do nothing till
Patrick. God, that's a beautiful voice. My God, you know, I don't understand white supremacy. I don't understand white privilege. What I'm saying is I don't understand why black people haven't, African American people haven't enslaved African American people, haven't been treated. That's the only art form that America has. I mean, America is a scumbag, insane culture, and they've been picking on, they've been suppressing the black vote and incarcerating in concentration camp Hispanics at the border. I really don't know why. I'm going to go out here into the zone here. I'm going to the zone. I'm going to do a zone thing here. I'm going to do a zone thing here. My God, have you no compassion for others? You middle-class, privileged professionals that you can't get rid of a guy like Donald Trump.
Well, hopefully they're going to get rid of him, but
I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced they will. But anyway, my point is, so now we had a little pause there. It's 10:36. I will go out there. I love Billie Holiday. Why don't we just do the other record player a little bit of Langston Hughes?
Okay.
And I'll go out and try to dial up him, and then we'll come back and we'll take care of poetry, the spirit of the spoken word, which has been done for, 48 years, and Patrick is doing a great job following up on it. So are we doing sort of all right for now, Patrick?
Yeah.
We got another 20 minutes.
And here goes some nice
Langston Hughes. Yeah.
This is Langston Hughes. Many of my poems are poems about the Negro people in relation to American democracy and about the problems of American democracy in general as applied to race. The first poem is called Afro-American Fragment. So long, so far away is Africa. Not even memories alive, save those that history books create, save those that songs beat back into the blood, beat out of blood with words sad sung in strange un-Negro tongue. So long, so far away is Africa. Subdued and time lost are the drums, and yet there comes this song I do not understand, this song of atavistic land, of bitter yearnings lost without a place. So long, so far away is Africa's dark face. This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems, written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time, my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans, and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. This one is a poem almost as old as The Negro Speaks of Rivers. It was written when I was perhaps 21. It's called Negro. I'm a Negro, black as the night is black like the depths of my Africa. I've been a slave. Caesar told me to keep his doorsteps clean. I brushed the boots of Washington. I've been a worker. Under my hand, the pyramids arose. I made mortar for the Woolworth Building. I've been a singer. All the way from Africa to Georgia, I carried my sorrow songs. I made ragtime. I've been a victim. The Belgians cut off my hands in the Congo. They lynch me now in Mississippi. I am a Negro, black as the night is black like the depths of my Africa. American Heartbreak. I am the American heartbreak, rock on which freedom stumps its toe. The great mistake that Jamestown made. Dream Variations. This poem, like the first one that I read, has overtones of Africa. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like meme. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl, till the quick day is done. Rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me. When I was a child in Lawrence, Kansas.
Actually, that's the great Langston Hughes. Black Like Me was a very important book. Langston was a busboy in New York City, and come on, do it right, Walt. come on. Vachel Lindsay discovered his poetry and put him on the stage. I want to go to my friend David Hedges. I don't know. I'm not going to worry about Ray Burley. His book is called Presidential Posies, and I respect him enormously, but he didn't call in at 10:15, so we're at 10:43. I spoke with David Hedges was at Foucault Bookstore. But I think what I would like is just one more Billie Holiday song, and then I'll play off the tape all recorder. Right. Just see, I don't know where it is. Let's hear the woman's voice.
Headphones must not be working.
I'm not working. Okay, the hell with the headphones. Let's keep talking. Okay, let her play. Let me hear her headphones. God, I love what's going on. Oh. plugged in.
Yeah, I turned it off. So
go ahead. I want to hear Billie Holiday.
Some more? Okay.
Hush now, don't explain.
Billy down here.
Lipstick.
We're gonna go to David Hedges here. Okay, David Hedges. And I have to put it down here. Okay, I'm gonna do it. Here, we'll go.
It's a collection of poems and memoirs.
Prospects of life after death.
Formal poetry. And that will be at the Cult Bookstore tonight. So I'm going to stop.
How he wrote the paper, the newspaper advertising.
So we're live at Foucault, Mother Foucault Bookstore. It's all right.
I could tell you how he is a longtime president of the Oregon State Poetry Association and longtime board member of the.
That's
Oregon
his son, Andrew.
And how he, as I think Walt was alluding to, co-founded the Oregon Poetry Collection at Knight Library at the University of Oregon, and was awarded the Stuart H. Holbrook Literary Legacy Award for his contributions to Oregon's literary life. I could tell you all this. However, what I wanted to is pose a question. So you're about to hear a bunch of stories. Stories which I consider mischievous and adventurous. But one of my dad's classmates in high school, a local Portland attorney, when he read the book and read the stories, exclaimed, "Crime on crime!" That's great, really. That's wonderful.
So, is that on the cover?
That's nowhere is the book on the cover.
The reviews are in. Yeah.
But, you know, it's easy. It was easy for me to look at these stories, to read these stories, and think that that was just a simpler time, right? But my dad was born in 1937. In 1937, fascism was on the march in Europe. Imperialism was on the march in Asia. The world was stumbling out of the Great Depression and into the Second World War, just a generation after the war to end all wars. Simple time by in a lot of ways. So I guess my question to you all is, you know, here's this boy growing up in Northeast Portland with a big imagination, a penchant for storytelling, and an oversized sense of wonder about the world. So maybe it's not so much that the times are that different, but is there something in ourselves that we can tap into where we can have a little bit of that perspective on the times we live in? That's you, David Hedges.
The sound should be louder, David.
What's that?
The sound
should be a little closer to the mic.
What if I don't use it at all?
No, we can't hear you.
That's okay.
No, you got to use it, David.
Okay, anyway, I'm going to dive right in. I
warm. Demented by the drug this one nurse used to keep me in the oven, snug, bald Doc Frisbee took his ever-loving blue-eyed time. Deformed when the forceps fused my malleable skull a tiny bit, because the OB book had failed to say a thing about a laid-back baby's birth, and I resisted. God, I fought. Who wouldn't start a scrap with room and board provided free for all his world was worth, when what he held could not be weighed or measured on a map? It wasn't old Doc Frisbee's fault the night nurse pushed me back. His trolley plowed to Halsey Street before the pulley froze, and while he trekked a dozen blocks alone along the track to Portland Sanitarium through wildly blowing snows, I twice poked out as if to ask a favor, and the nurse reversed me with the flat of her hand pressed against my head, scolding my wide-eyed mother as the everlasting curse of her profession, how she could secure a post instead in daytime dresses, lingerie, perfumes at Meyer and Frank, and should indeed be home in bed letting her sweet dreams bloom. Lo and behold, the doc arrived and gave my bottom a spank, dangling me by the ankles while I wailed farewell to the womb, wondering who in creation dreamt this dreadful atmosphere, the sickly cotton gowns and masks, the off-white tile floor, the wrinkled rubber ether bag, the lights designed with fear in mind by demons lurking just outside the OR door. That was my introduction to the world. And this was as told to me by my mother, though not in iambic heptameter. The next poem is one that starts with the cover. That's me at three. And segues into another one of my mother's favorite stories, A Teller of Tall Tales. I keep my childhood portrait close at hand. It makes an honest man of me when fraud and artifice advance their lotus land temptations as the perfect path to God. Those curly locks, those rosy cheeks, those eyes hand-tinted blue, a chin that seems to nod assent when I throw off my thin disguise of lies as who I am, the good, the bad, the ugly, all the in-betweens. Surprise is what I sometimes see, as if the lad has made a study of my closet's bones, and though my alibis are ironclad, tisk tisk, and plays my ribs like xylophones. I am a picnic basket full of me, a fleet of small boats ballasted with stones afloat like bottles bobbing on the sea. A child no more, yet not some churlish brute locked in his ways. I court hyperbole. When I was five, my sense of sight acute, I saw the leaders of the Axis fly low overhead, and I, an absolute control of all the universe, the sky above my house on Hancock Street included, ran inside and with a cry of fright revealed what I had seen, replete with details only I was privy to. My mom, her voice as always, firm yet sweet, said, Hitler, Mussolini, is this true? Thus forced to face reality, I said, no, only Mussolini. And I knew with superheated sparkling, watershed elucidation, one day I'd become a teller of tall tales, a fountainhead of modern myth. Though, as a high school chum scrawled in my yearbook, don't misunderstand, old friend, but you'd be splendid as a bum. We lived a couple blocks from Sullivan's Gulch, and all the parents told all the kids to stay away from Sullivan's Gulch, which for me and my buddy Mackie was a magnet. And so I got to know Hooverville, hobos, and it was more than once chased by railroad dicks. Down in Sullivan's Gulch, I wrenched the clump of Johnson grass free moments before the old switch engine lurches back to life, wheezing. Oh, you made it.
Yeah. Hi, Scotty. You got it. You're here, darling.
Darling.
Okay. To rest the clump of Johnson grass free moments before the old switch engine lurches back to life, wheezing. With the right loft, the right twist of my wrist, I can plant the grass deep in the stack until pressure blows the soot black mass sky high and thick smoke drives engineer and fireman down out of the cab, wide-eyed. Thoughts swing to my first time on the rope, my first plunge in the billows of alien air belched from the silver-painted throat of the Portland roads, St. Louis bound. The time I doubled Mackey's dare by holding on with just one hand, out through the fiery blast and back, breathless, eyes tight against the sting, until at last I stood at the bank's trembling lip, let go the rope, dropped to the soft dirt, cupped between the leaning fir trees' twisted roots, and laughed to tears, while Mackey, hands stuffed in pockets, scuffed his heels in the thick dust, studying defeat. The engine hisses, stutters, spits steam jets along the polished rails and down the raised bed of crushed rock and creosote-coated ties, splashing the tar-black gravel by the water tank, and spins its wheels for the Gandhi dancers lounging by the pool shed, as if headed for the stretch of track that hugs the Columbia River like a snake, up the gorge where it hauled 100 freight cars in its glory days. Back and forth, using both hands, I swing the jumbo clump of Johnson grass, letting go, betting last week's allowance, a buffalo nickel, on the twist of my wrist.
That's David Hedges' Prospects of Life After Birth and The Talking Earth. And we're almost gone. We could just go out with a little bit of Billie Holiday. And I don't know. Did it work? Does the spoken word work? Thank you all.
Yeah.
And you know what, Patrick Bocard, my engineer, thank you so much. But everyone, you need to know to support KBU and all of that. Put on Billy just for a minute, and if he wants to. Just it's transition out of here, the Talking Earth, Walt Curtis and Patrick Bocard, and we're done.
What can I do? My man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just despair. But I don't care when he takes me in his arms.